Father, my goodness, there is a lot of you. I'm so proud to be here tonight. Last night we had our duties, giving comfort to the disturbed and all set to disturb the comfortable. I like that. You talk about we was masochistic. I'll talk to you about that later. I'd like her to run that by me one more time. Said she was a slow learner. I think we all understood what she meant. Then we had that Baptist preacher, Bill Warner, that knee-skinning drunk. Well, I understood that. Pulled his pants up to admire his knees. I like that. I haven't done it lately. Said he needed walking around since. And I thought that was good. I thought that was real good. Kitty Lou. Well, we're all out here attracting all the people we can. My golly, that's yours. I think she attracted me. She's a cute little old gal. Maxine Walford, our alcoholic addict. Bearing out her heart in a story that I know was mighty hard for a lady to tell. I guess it's kind of a little bit harder for some of you girls to talk about this thing than it is us fellas. So this true, a man can go behind the signboard and take out an old razor blade and shave a little, dig down in an old sack, pull out a kind of clean shirt, walk down the street, but I never run across no women behind them signboards. That is shaving. That's Bill O'Neill. Lord have mercy, somebody got my seat up front, and I had to sit back there, but I could hear every word he said. And he said something about adding an O to God, and you had good. And I like that. Because it's kind of hard for me to grab a hold of this God thing at first. And he's talking about being cantankerous. I could go along with him on that. I was a cantankerous drunk myself, and I was argumentative along with it. And I remember one time as a fella I was arguing with, and he said, "Did you tell so-and-so I was a S.O.B.?" I said, "No, Lord, I messed that enough. Where is it?" Let me start over. I'll see how good an audience you are. I was arguing with this old boy one day, and I said, "Did you tell so-and-so I was a S.O.B.?" He said, "No. I don't know how he found out." (Laughter) Then I met Wade, and I heard about how Wade was connected with this thing. Wade come in the room and he talked with me and he told me some about the history of this and how he was connected with it and how his fondest hope was that it was successful and would bring a message of love to other alcoholics, and sort of fell in love with Wade too. Well, met another fella named Noel Quinn came in, and he told me that he never had seen me before, but he had heard the tape of mine some 10 years ago, and it had brought him around to getting sober, and that he had loved me for 10 years. And I told him, I said, Noel, I believe you sort of made my night for me. I was met at the plane. I flew down in a plane. Anybody can fly without one. The rest of we all did. By an old friend of mine that I'm sure you all know, Mr. Humility himself, sitting over there with that blue coat. That coat, he says, he won in a humility contest. I don't know how many of you have met Franklin Williams, but you better let him bless you a little before you get out tonight. And then I met old Bald is Beautiful. And I want you to know that he's got his picture here on Ramada Inn. You notice that? See it there? You posed for that, didn't you? You got a book of them matches with a Ramada Inn. His picture's on that with a yellow vest and a red coat. See that? And I'm glad to be here, and I feel mighty good tonight because I put on my speaking suit. This is my speaking suit. And I reached my hand down in my pocket, and there was a little piece of paper there, and I thought maybe I'd left a dollar or something in it. And it was a little note that my wife had put in there for me to see while I was dressing to get ready to talk for this meeting. She said, "Hi, darling. Just wanted to tell you I'd be thinking of you about now and all through the evening. I know they will love you, but not as much as I do. Have a good time and miss me as much as I miss you. All my love." Ain't that nice? Now, folks, when you got a wife that loves you and you're invited back home to talk, you're a success. And Arkansas is my home. I was born over in Garland County, Arkansas, in Hot Springs, and I was raised in Little Rock, North Little Rock, and I acted in such a way it was necessary for me to leave home. They called me the Arkansas Traveler, but I didn't want to go. They suggested I leave, and seemed like everywhere I got, they thought it'd be better if I go somewhere else too. So I became quite a traveler, and I became a low-bottom drunk, And when I say I was a low-bottom drunk, I don't mean I was just late for work. I was fired from washing dishes in a Greek restaurant. When you get fired from washing dishes in a Greek restaurant, you are unemployable. I remember one time I was down in Shreveport and I was hungry, and I went in this Chinese restaurant and told this time when I was hungry, and could I do some work for something to eat? He said, "You like your rabbit?" And I've had visions of rabbit and dumplings. Loved it. I said, "Deed I do." He said, "You catch him, I cook him." I've been known to be uncouth. Now, I try to be cool, but it just don't come out that way. Like, shortly after I came to AA, why they let me go to a dance. And I was dancing with them folks and just having a time, I'm telling you. And after one of the dances, a fella come over to me and he said, "Charlie, after you dance with these ladies, you're supposed to kind of say something kind of nice to them." And so after the next dance, I told this lady, I said, "You know, I believe you sweat less than any fat woman I ever danced with." Well, he told me that wasn't exactly what he meant. So if I should happen to say something tonight with which you disagree, or don't understand, or would like to talk to me about after the meeting, feel free. I haven't got anywhere as near ready to graduate yet. And I doubt very much if there's a person in this room that you and me together don't know more than just me by myself. And I respect every one of you. I respect why you're here. I respect your feelings. But I do get carried away once in a while, because my story, the first part of it is right sad. And the last half is just plumb pitiful. But I don't guess if your story ain't pretty sad, I don't guess you got any right to be here, have you? I've never heard of anybody come running through the door and say, "Hold everything, I've got something for you." Everybody come in here looking for something, and I was no exception. And I was over home there back last August, and I went over and visited some of my relatives, some cousins, Bart, Dart, and Fargo. And I was telling old Fargo about my hard luck, and he said, "Well, you didn't have no hard time." He said, "We've got a family that lives over the ridge here that we call this fella Hard Luck Clyde." And said old Hard Luck has got a little old weakly wife and 7 or 8 wormy kids and a right puny mule and a broke down plow that he's trying to eke out a living on 40 acres of the poorest ground you ever seen in your life. And the other morning he went out there and put that plow in the ground and hooked it up to that mule and went up a furrow about 20 feet, and this plow hit a root, jerked that mule, he dropped dead, broke the plow all to pieces, and poor old hard luck Clyde just dropped them reins and looked up at the clouds in the sky and said, "Why, Lord? Why?" And the sky turned black, just dark, and a shaft of light shone through an opening in the clouds from heaven right on old hard luck Clyde. And this booming voice come and said, "Clyde." Somehow or other, it just seems like you kind of tee me off. Well, Lord, this broke old Clyde up. I mean, he is upset something wonderful. And he went over to a neighbor of his house and told him what had happened. He said, "Even the Lord's mad at me." This fellow said, "Well, what you've got to do is move to town and straighten up and get on welfare. Get you one of them low-cost housing developments and straighten up." He did. He moved to town, took all them little old wormy kids and his puny wife in, got them settled down there, and one of them, and the checks started coming in, and the welcome wagon come and run over him. He said, "Now there's a fellow that has hard luck," and he didn't even drink. Well, I guess I was ordinary garden variety, run-of-the-mill alcoholic. Like everybody else. But I like to look at this thing like it was a ladder of life. And everybody is standing on one of the rungs of their ladder of life. Now, if you're some kind of a big shot, like the chairman of the board of some big corporation, why, you got a ladder runs way up into the ethereal. I mean, you're roaming around up above the clouds there somewhere. Don't nobody know what you're doing. And I mean, you can make a lot of mistakes and run up and down your ladder just like somebody playing one of them fiddle things. And nobody will know it because your children are still fed and going to school. You got your bills paid. Your church dues are paid up. And according to society, you look like you're doing fine. Then there's them middle class folks somewheres, and they got pretty long ladders too. That's them bricklayers and cotton farmers and salesmen and housewives and teachers and the taxpayers. Them folks, they've got a pretty long ladder too, and they can make quite a few mistakes and run up and down before society recognizes they got a problem. Then there's them folks that are pretty far down on the ladder, way down in here, and they're the folks that things are about to pop. You know, I mean, the wife's about ready to go a bag fast. And she's ready to just take off, and his boss is ready to fire him. And then there's folks like me. I had the shortest little ladder you ever seen, and it was sitting in a hole. And as a result, I didn't have to, you know, they call this a disease. And I didn't have no symptoms, I just went on into the disease. Well, first time I ever got a drink in my life, I got drunk and passed out in the backyard where we raised chickens. Now, I don't know if you ever passed out in a chicken lot or not, but boy, you a mess. We raised them old Rhode Island Reds. Plymouth, they're them messy kind. I had passed out in my new hat. My mother come back in the backyard and found me, and she never had seen me looking like that before. In fact, she never had seen nobody looking like that. Took me in the house and gave me the only therapy she knew, a hot bath and a dose of castor oil and an enema. I was the cleanest drunk in Arkansas, inside and out. And if I'd have had any sense at all, I'd have quit drinking right there. Just quit, because I could get sick. Lord, I could get sick. Even my hair hurt. Fingernails. Well, I was down a rung on my ladder of life, but Lord, I couldn't remember none of the suffering. All I could remember was how tall I got and how strong and how pretty. I used to get downright pretty when I got to drinking. Just, and the boss fired me. Of course, I'm down another rung on the ladder of life, and when he fired me, I remember that I walked nearly out the door, and then I went back, and I said, "Mr. Mitchell, what caused you to come to this decision? How come you did?" He said, "Well," he said, "the porter was complaining about you puking in the trash. And it is you or him." Well, I left and I thought, now I'll go home and wait. He'll call. They can't run that place without me. And I went home and waited for him to call. I was patient. I waited years. And while I was waiting for him to call, I sent what money we had in the bank, $12. And then I started a negotiation. That's when you take the toaster out under your coat, you know, heading for the bootleggers and the waffle iron. And then I started higher negotiations. That's when you call up the second-hand dealer and you say, "What are you giving for 9x12 rugs today and sofa?" Well, it is during these higher negotiations that my wife left and took the dogs with her. Oh, I missed that dog. Do you ever notice when folks come in to talk at a thing like this, they nearly always lost their wife? You ever notice that? I did. I lost two or three wives. And I don't know how many like housekeepers. Well, anyway, I finished drinking up the furniture, and there I was, left there in a empty house, just me and a soggy mattress. Some of you might know how it got soggy. And bottles. Anytime you pull a drawer out, why, it'd be full of bottles. You wonder, who's drinking all this whiskey? And actually, if you're sitting there right now wondering whether you're an alcoholic or not, this is your criteria. You can get them bottles in, but you can't get them out. You ever have that trouble? There used to be a park near where we were, and I'd take a whole great stack of bottles out in the park, way out, and look around, and it'd be late at night. Wouldn't be nobody up but me and the police. And I wouldn't just take that sack and set it down, you know, and walk away. I'd sow them like seeds. I never could figure out why I did that until I got tangled up with a psychiatrist. And we come to that part, and he said that I had a trauma. I said, did? He said, like how? And he said, well, you was protecting garbage men. I said, come by me again with how do I protect God? He said, well, everybody in town knew you was a drunk, but the garbage man. And that's true. I would not put an empty in my trash. I would put it in the neighbor's trash. Oh, them psychiatrists say something, I'll see if I got time. Actually, you know, I just keep on talking till my time's up, because my story's so long, I haven't heard it all myself. It's a fact. But then we've all got a job to do here tonight. But my job is to talk. And your job is to listen. If you get through before I do, why, just go on home. Well, I'm down another rung on my ladder of life, and then I come to the point where I sold the house, drank that up, and then I sold the very last thing I possessed. My old automobile, it just could not stay sober. Had run into everything in Arkansas. It even had knots on top. And a friend of mine explained to me after I'd sobered up, he said, that was when you running through the woods and the top would hit them low limbs. You go ahead and use it, and I'll, as you drink your beer, I'll keep tabs and let you know when I bought it. And one day he said, hey Charlie, guess what? I said, what? He said, you just drunk up your car. Well, I had to move back home with Mother. She is delighted. Her drunken son had come home. And I started negotiating with her stuff. She come home one day, and I was putting a washing machine on a truck, me and another drunk, and she let out a war whoop I hadn't heard since Reservation. And this fella, it scared me, and he flat disappeared. And seen him since. But I've been trying to more negotiate with her stuff, and then I got to the point then where I get arrested. You know, this getting arrested business, especially when you live in a town where everybody knows you, this comes along something like, you'll be walking down the street pretty drunk, and you'll come up on a policeman, and he'll say, "Charlie, for goodness sake, there you are again, drunk. I am surprised at you, coming from a good Christian family." You ever notice that's another thing? Nearly everybody here talking at these meetings like this always come from a good Christian family. Did you ever notice that? I'm beginning to believe that ain't no place to raise children. Anyway, he'd say, "Now, why don't you sober up and go on home to your poor mother and behave yourself?" And you'd have to go drink on another policeman's beach for the rest of that night. And then one time, around there in North Little Rock, they hired a policeman that didn't know I come from a good family. And when I come up on him, he just grabbed me by the seat of the pants and hooked me like that. He's off balance. And he is choking me is what he's doing. And he didn't say nothing. He just took me to the call box and called that wagon, and the wagon come, took me to the police station, put my name on the blotter, and opened that door and put me in and closed that door, and I'm over here, and the policeman out there on the other side of the door, and I got brave and got to telling them. I was thinking, you know, I believe they've got me locked up. And I got to telling them off in no uncertain terms. And loud, I was hollering at them. I was referring to their ancestry. But you know how it is when you first get locked up. Oh, you're loud and you're just yelling, but as time goes on and you get sober, you get quieter and quieter until finally you come up with something like, "Officer, what am I charged with? Can I please sir have a drink of water?" Nobody answers you, and you're in there all by yourself, and you're thinking, "I got to get out of here. I got responsibilities. I got to go to work. Haven't worked in 3 years." Then you get to thinking what you're going to say to the judge, and then what will the judge say to you. And then if he don't say that, you'll say this. That's called your alternate plan. All night long you rehearse, and you get quiet, and you're thinking. All night long you're rehearsing, and finally comes dawn. And they take you over and put you in the ante room, and they wait for them to call your name. And finally, they call your name. "Charles Lindenwood, you're charged with being drunk. How do you plead?" You say, "Guilty," and run on out. You're nervous, shaky. The wind's blowing up your pants leg, or at least it looks like it, because your knees are shaking. And both eyes are trying to get in the same socket. Well, then you call up somebody, everybody's got one of these little books, you know, and you open the book, dial your number. Hello, Joe. Joe, they got me locked up. How about something? He said, you didn't pay me the $10 for getting you out the other time. You scratch him off the list. Call up another number. Hello, Frank. Frank, you got me locked up. Yes, I know. I had you locked up. Scratch him off the list. You go on down the list and find out that nobody cares $10 worth whether you in or out. And then you find out what the judge means by 10 or 10. Because you have to do the 10. Days. And in Little Rock, they had this chain gang, and they put the drunks all up on a truck with some shovels and brooms, and they drove out to some place where it was dirty. And they let me off right there in front of the printing office where I'm waiting for them to call me back to work. Which might have had something to do with them not calling. And I had a broom about that wide with the most stiff bristles, and I'm sweeping. In the gutter, and I think, what a revolting development this is. Here I am in my own hometown sweeping this street. Somebody's going to come by here and see me doing this, and they will be horrified. They'll go down and put up some money. Sure enough, guy come by and knew me. Howdy, Charlie. Not only did he look like he wasn't surprised at me being there, but that I was late getting there. Well, this wasn't too bad doing time. Actually, I'd get arrested and turned loose. Somebody'd pay me out. Maybe I'd have $10. But anyway, I was getting in and out, in and out. I was doing life on the installment plan. Then one day they put me helping the dog catcher. I was in utopia because I love dogs and dogs love me, and all I had to do to get me a dog was go, I got a dog, and he's up in my arms and wagging his little tail and licking me on the face, and I put him up in the truck. We going for a little ride. Had him on his little head, you know, and he's licking my hand. Pretty soon, I got the whole truck full of dogs, and we went out to the dog pound, and he packed the truck up and opened the door at this great big steel enclosure. All the dogs went in there, and then he come over and hand me a bucket of paint with a brush like a stencil brush. And he said, Charlie, now I want you to take this brush and daub some of this paint up high on his neck where he can't lick it off. I said, for what? He said, well, you notice different dogs got different colored paint up there. He said, now this is how we tell how long we keep them, and if they've been here for over 2 weeks, we shoot them. I said, you mean to tell me that you had me around here in my own hometown picking up these nice little old dogs that somebody loves and that somebody's pet, and you bring them out here and you want me to put paint on them so that 2 weeks can shoot them? He looked at me like I'm some new kind of nut. He said, what the hell you think we're doing, just collecting dogs? Well, he had to go to another part of the pound for something, and he oughtn't have done it. You way ahead of me, ain't you? That's right. I turned all his dogs loose. When he got back, there ain't nobody there but me and one little old lady dog that won't go. And I'm saying, go, 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 go. He come up and he said, where have you gone? I said, I have turned your dog loose. That's what I have done. And he became upset. Took me back down and charged me again. Sent me out to the county farm. Pulaski County Farm, which is a farm where they raise things. And I never have been on no farm except with Uncle Wade. I had Uncle Wade. Uncle Wade and Uncle Ben, Uncle Ben was my drinking uncle. I loved him. Took after him. And anyway, they brought me out on this farm, and they set me off of their truck, me and about 10 other peck of wood, and the captain. Captain come over, and he said, we going over to the tool house. He talked at the street. He said, we going over to the tool shed. You get some tools. I was concerned about it. He wasn't concerned about me, though. Anyway, we went over and we got these hoes and we marched out the turn row and got out to a cornfield, and it was in the spring of the year. And the corn was just up about 2 inches. And the captain stopped his horse there and we all stopped and he said, now, boys, he said, that corn out there is mine. And that Johnson grass is yours. And I want you to get your Johnson grass out of my car. He said, leave 3 to a hill. And everybody started up the road chopping. Well, I went well. I'm leaving 3 or something. Because at that stage of the game, when corn's up just about 2 inches and Johnson grass growing in monster, they both look just exactly alike. Well, I ain't up this row there. I bet I ain't up to 15, 20 feet. Here come the captain on this great, big, beautiful black horse. And he looks at me and he says, son, you don't know much about farming, do you? I said, no. I figured he's going to put me in the office where I belong. He said, I'm going to teach you the difference between corn and Johnson grass. I thought, ain't he a nice man? Here that man is going to take time out from his busy day on this great big farm to give me a lesson in horticulture. He said, get down. I said, get down. He said, yeah, just lay down there on your stomach. I began to suspect something. I laid down there, and he went over to that great, big, beautiful black horse and got the leather. About 4 inches wide, made out of shoe leather, about that long. And had a wooden handle on it, about like that. And he fondly caressed that with his foot. And made that end stand up just like that. And then unfurled it on my posterior. That means he hit me hard. And holler, you could have heard me to town. He gave me 3 licks. And you know, when I got up from there, I could tell corn from Johnson grass. Far as I could see it. He taught me near about all there was to know about horticulture. With that same little educational implement. He taught me how to dig ditches so that they would drain just right So, and that no water would collect in there to make room for mosquitoes to breathe, and yet would drain the pipe. He taught me how to grade roads. He gave me 3 licks on everything. Anything he taught me how to do. He couldn't just tell me how to do it. He had to say, get out. And when he gave me them 3 licks, I knew how to do it. He taught me how to mend fences and mend roofs to keep potatoes from freezing in the wintertime. Taught me how to milk cows and take care of the pigs. Taught me how to plow. This was early in the morning in the spring of the year, and it ain't near daylight, and somebody is shaking me. Said, hey, Charlie, get up. You on the plow squad this trip. I said, I don't know anything about plowing. He said, we'll teach you. And I tightened up so that I could feel that leather. They took me out in the lot and assigned 2 real frisky blue-nosed mules to me that knew I didn't know anything about mules. And held them tall, proud heads up. I couldn't even reach them, much less get a bridle on. Them peckerwoods lasted me for a while, and then finally a couple of them got a hold of that soft nose, brought it down and twisted that ear and got that bridle on there. We went out to the turn row and hooked it up to that plow, and here we go out across the field, and I left the fur, looked like a nervous snake. Here come the captain. Come up there on that great big beautiful black horse, and he said, looks like I'm going to have to teach you to plow, don't it, son? I said, do you? He always called me son. I called him son, too. Very quiet. He said, get down. I got down. You give me 3. I got up. I looked at Bruce and Eagle. That was them mules' name, Bruce and Eagle. Bruce was standing there just kind of non-committal. And Eagle had a sort of a smirk on his face, and one of them ears laying at a 90-degree angle. I knew I had to get their attention. I went down the turn row and picked up a limb, about the equivalent of a 2x2, and come back and laid it on them right between the eyes. Wow! And man, them mules straightened up at attention, both ears right up in the air. And I told him, I said, now, boys, the captain said that we got to have a straight fur, or somebody going to get their ass tore up. And it ain't going to be mine. Well, I had got through to them. And the captain had already got through to me. Lord, we went out across that field, and you could have put a chance in on one of them furs. I mean, this is straight. Now, why is that? Why is that that nobody can tell us drunk the way things are and the way they should be, and have us accept them and go ahead and do them like we're told to do? We got to learn everything the hard way. I remember when I'd be leaving that institution, and it had gotten to the point where they didn't want me around home anymore, and I didn't have a job downtown, and I had lost my strata in society. And I think every one of you know what I mean when I say that I lost my strata, every one of you people here move and breathe in some circle, some social circle, and wherever this is and with whomever it may be, you associate on a basis of equality and understanding. And I had lost my status with my family. I'd lost my status with my former peers. I'd lost my status with my former companions, and I had worked my way down to where I was associating with people of lesser and lesser ilk, until finally I was drinking with the guys underneath the bridge, and I was jailbait. You know, you can stay out of jail for a long time. Thank the Lord for this mayor that gave me one free arrest. I might be able to make it out of town tonight. But you all know what I mean by drinking your way down, away from your rightful place in this life. And I had done this, and I felt at home out there on the county farm because they gave me Bruce and Eagle as my regular mules. And I loved old Bruce and Eagle, and I worked with them and I talked with them. And I was good to them. I'd steal things. I'd steal cabbage to give to them. And I'd steal a little celery if I'd get it. I'd steal apples and give to them. And when I'd get a couple of extra nickels and I'd be at the store, I'd always buy something in there for old Bruce and Eagle. And it got to where I could talk to them, and I poured my heart out to them, just like we pour our hearts out to each other. And there wasn't a human being in the world that I could tell how sad I was and how much I wanted my mother and how much I wanted the love of my wife and the understanding of my family, but I could tell it to old Bruce and Eagle. And they'd stand there and somehow I kind of felt like they understood and that they sympathized. And I'd curry old Bruce and Eagle until they'd just shine. And I could walk out in the lot in the morning to get those mules, and when it would be cool and the other guys would be having a hard time getting their mules, run around the lot, all I'd do is be come on out in there and say, "Let's go, Bruce. Come on, Eagle." And them old mules would come behind me, nudging me with their soft nozzle, and I loved it. I loved this feeling of being wanted and needed, even if it was this county farm where men have died under the leather. When I got out there, I felt that there was a place for me, and that I'd get out in the field, or I'd be hauling logs with old Bruce and Eagle. I talked to them. I never hit them. After that initial time to get their attention. And I guess it sounds a little squirrely, but the only time when I was doing time at all was at the very first and at the end of it, because before the judge would give me my time, I'd wonder what I was going to get. I kind of felt like a June bride. I knew I was going to get something, but I didn't know how much. And then when my time was up, when I'd coming close to the end and I knew that I was going to be set free on the road to get back out in the free world where nobody wanted me and there was no place to go, I'd get fidgety and nervous and scared. Where was I going to go and what was I going to do? See, I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know I had a disease. I never heard of alcoholism. And I've never heard of you wonderful people. If anybody would have ever told me that I would stand before a group of grand people like you one time in my life and have you paying attention to what I was saying, I'd think I was NDTs again. So I'd go to the captain the night or two before I was going to leave, and I'd tell him, well, Captain, I'm going to leave this time, and I'm not going to come back. And he'd say, yes, I know. And I'd mean that thing because I'd swear to God and to myself. And I'd mean that thing with every fiber in my body. I'd say, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to straighten up, and I'm going to fly right, and I'm going to make my family proud of me. I'm going to be the kind of a son and husband and father that I ought to be. I'd go downtown and I'd get lost. I'd get lost in the same jungle that I'd been lost for as many years as I'd been active in my disease of alcoholism. And I'd run into an old buddy and he'd say, hey, Charlie, when you get out? I always just got out. And I said, just got out. He said, man, let's go have a brew. No, sir, I'm not going to take a drink. I'm going to straighten up and fly right. All I want is a job and a couple of bucks to get me some socks and a place to sleep tonight. I'm going to get a job. And he said, oh, man, that's good. Fine, let's go get a drink to celebrate. I said, okay. And we'd go sit in the beer joint and say, draw one. And them studs would come and they'd be so cool going down. And then I'd start growing and I'd look in that mirror behind the bar and I had little bitty arms and wear a t-shirt and that nerve in my arm had started jumping and I thought it was a muscle. And I'd look in that mirror and I'd shine that tooth. Drunks get down pretty low on teeth and I had proceed. He said, now if I poke your eyes out, what'll happen? I said, couldn't see. He said, that's good thinking. Now he says, what would happen if I cut your ears off? I said, I couldn't see. He said, go back. Now let's go back. What would happen if I poked your eyes out? I said, couldn't see. He said, try to retain this trend of thought. He said, now what would happen if I cut your ears off? I said, I couldn't see. He said, how in the world do you arrive at this? I said, well, if you cut my ears off, my hat would fall down over my eyes and it couldn't see. Well, you had to explain little things like that to us. I mean, things everybody else just knows automatically. He said, did you ever have DTs? I said, I had them when they first come out. He said to me one day, he says, now, today, I want you to give me a rundown on your day. I said, like how? He said, well, what I want you to do is tell me what transpires in your thinking process and what manifests itself therefrom. I said, run that by me one more time. Oh, you done miss me all again. He says, now, what I want to know is, when you first wake up in the morning, I said, do you want to know what do I do when I first wake up in the morning? Well, I was wrong again. He said, I want to know what you think of and then what you do and what you think and what you do as the day progresses. Well, now, knowing this old bird as I did, I knew his red wasn't brown on both sides. And he was liable to leave the limb at any time. And I had developed a kind of a paternal interest in him, you know. Wanted to protect him. Because he was ill. In fact, he is weird. Well, I was weighing this very carefully because I knew our day didn't parallel and I was going to shock him. So, after careful consideration, I said, well, first thing I do when I wake up in the morning is open my eyes. And knowing him as I did, I explained why. I said, reason I do this is to see where I wound up. And damn if I didn't have to explain that. Seemed like he woke up in the same place the other morning, I guess. Well, I said, once I do this and I determine where I am, I said, I look around the room, if it is a room, and then I sit on the side of the bed, if it is a bed, and scratch, and belt, and a light a cigarette, and vomit. His eyes bugged out, he said, son. I said, oh yeah, man, everybody does this. And he didn't know it. He did not know that everybody curled up when they got up in the morning. Didn't know that. Oh, he is sick. He said to me one day, he said, now, today we're going to go into your childhood. I said, go ahead. You've been everywhere else. He said, as a child, did you bite your fingernail? I said, well, I don't know. I don't like them now. He said, did you pick your nose? I said, when it needs it. He said, did you wet your bed? I said, still Jews. But doctor, I have got news for you. You are trying to find out the cause of my drinking. Wetting the bed is not a cause of drinking. This is a result of drinking. And if you don't believe this, you just get yourself about a half a case of brew and follow that with 2 or 3 skullbusters, and then take a couple of goofballs so you will relax. And if you don't wake up in a puddle, there's something wrong with your kidneys. Well, the old fellow was getting a little upset, and he kind of remained that way, and when he'd get upset, it'd make me upset. And one day there, I was kind of nervous, and we was talking, and he was talking, and I was rolling this little black ball around in my hand. And he was talking, and I was rolling, and finally he got to watching this operation and couldn't keep his eyes off of me rolling this little black ball around in my hand. Finally he said, "Why are you rolling that little black ball around in your hand?" I said, "Well, you ain't the easiest man in the world to talk to, and seem like this kind of soothes my nerves." He said, "Do you mind if I try?" "No, no, go ahead." I handed him the little black ball. He rolled it around on his hand. He grinned, you know. He said, "Does soothe your nerves, don't it?" I said, "Eat it, you. Eat it, you." He said, "Where did you get it?" I said, "Out of my nose." That was just before they sent me to the nut house. Me and him both. I got out. He didn't make it. Well, I guess I'm about at the end of my social drinking now. You know what social drinking is? That's when somebody says, "I think I shall have a drink." You say, "Socialize." That's what I thought social drinking was. They let me out of the nut house, and I came home, and I walked up the walk. I got drunk on the way home to celebrate getting out. My mother was sitting on the front porch watching for me when I got home, and she got up and she came down the walk and met me about halfway down the walk. I wasn't real drunk. just sort of drunk. Mother could tell, she could smell alcohol over the telephone. She knew I was drinking. When she came down the wharf, she was crying. And I could see the tears well up in her eyes and course down her cheeks. I could see her lips quiver, and her chin was all bunched up like an orange. And she said, "Son, I love you with all my heart. You're a wanted child, but I can't have you here at home any longer. You've acted in such a way that you've embarrassed the whole family, and I want you to leave and not ever come back until such time as you can conduct yourself as a man." I remember as I looked at my mother, she seemed so small and so frail. My mother had a lot of Choctaw Indian blood in her. Her name was Bertie Bronco. And she didn't cry much, and she never showed a lot of emotion. And I remember as I looked at her, only thing I could feel was, this is a fine time to wean a fella. And I remember that I turned around and walked down the walk, and I turned back and said, "All right, if that's the way you're going to act, I'll go be a bum." And I did. I kept that promise. I remember so many things that happened on my way down the rungs of the ladder of life to make me eligible for membership in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They say that after a person has been sober for some certain length of time, he don't remember what it's like. But I'm in my 27th year of total abstinence in this program, and I remember something just as if it was still happening. And I heard something tonight from Wade. Wade uses the term looking into that rear view mirror. And I stole that. That's the last time I'll ever give you credit for it. I love that. In fact, everything that you've heard come out of me tonight, I had to hear from somebody else because I didn't have any sense at all when I came. Say, I couldn't mumble my own name. So if I say anything that you don't like, you be careful who you tell it to. You may be talking to the one that I got it from. I remember the first time that I ever drank any Rubby Dub. I remember the first time that I ever drank any Bay Rum. First time I ever drank any Rubby Dub, I was on the bum and had been down to Louisiana. I don't know if you ever been to Monroe or know where Five Corners is or the Shamrock, but I was over there drinking Sweet Lucy. And I got a little drunk and went over to the jailhouse, escorted, with 30 days to visit them there. And as I went in this jail, I noticed the 10 prisoners in there. was kind of far out. Like that. And when they went to look from one thing to another, they didn't just look like that, you know. And I said, what's with y'all? And this one fellow that was kind of lucid said, we're coasting. I said, on what? He said, goofball. I said, give me some. He handed me a goofball and said, go ahead and take that and come back in 2 hours, and if I ain't busy, I'll give you another one. Well, I don't know how he's going to be busy. He ain't doing nothing but time. 2 hours, I come back, and he give me another one, and I was coasting too. But I guess my sled was a little faster than the most of them fellas, and my heel was steeper or something. Anyway, that thing affected my extremities. My hands and my legs and that, and whenever I'd start to reach for something with my arm or hand, my leg would run out on the stem. And as a result, I was grounded. And I sat there coasting for 30 days, and when my time was up, I couldn't go. Two policemen come and got me and set me on the front step and said, when you're able, leave. I went back down to the Shamrock and sat there, and there's two railroads crossed right there, and each of them railroads has to stop before they can proceed. And I'd wait for a freight train, and sometimes a freight train would come up with 100 cars on it and stop at this crossing and take off, go and it'd get flung away before I'd ever notice it. I was some kind of mixed up and fouled up anyway. I finally got on the freight train, got over in Mississippi, and I'm sitting on the levee and I'm sick. Woo! I'm purple. When you're purple, you're sick. And you talk about your hair hurting, I hurt her way down the track. And this bum walked up and looked at me and he said, you look like you're sick. I said, I am. He said, if you've got 25 cents, I know where we can get a drink. And I had 25 cents and handed it to him and held his coat for security. He went somewhere and he come back with this package all done up drugstore style, and he unwrapped it, and he took that top off, he handed it to me and said, here, boy, take the fusel oil off of it. I looked at it, and it said, rubbing alcohol, if taken internally, serious gastric disturbances will result. And they did. But Lord, I never had drank in a rubber jug before, and I looked at that and I handed it back to the man. I can't drink that. He took a slug of it, and pretty soon he's dancing and telling stories and laughing and talking and wanting to shake hands. I said, give me the bottle. He handed me the bottle, and I took a big slug and lost it. He said, that ain't no way to drink rub-a-dub. The way you drink rub-a-dub is take a little bit in your mouth and hold it there until the saliva dilutes it. And then you swallow it. You got your rub-a-dub cocktail. It was my first mixed drink. Lord, we got to drinking this rub-a-dub, and you know there ain't nobody in the world loves one another like two drunks. Nobody. We took up housekeeping underneath the bridge. Was nice. Had running water, cross ventilation. But the local gendarmes took a dim view to our activities. and we got 30 days in the Greenville, Mississippi County Jail. Lord, sick, woo, and stink. Gray, I thought was him. He thought was me. Them other prisoners knew who it was. He said, Charlie, I know this old jailer real well. He said, his name is Carroll. And if you will tell Mr. Carroll that you've got a bad leg, he will saturate a piece of cotton with rubber dub, and we will squeeze it in this milk bottle and have a little drink. Mr. Carroll came up, and I said, Mr. Carroll, do you think, please, sir, that you could find it in your heart to give me a little something for my leg? I have an injured leg, and I'm in pain. He said, why, certainly, son. Came up and handed me a whole pint of rubby dub. Woo! We mixed it in that quart bottle and put that water in there to fill it up and folded them two ingredients together. Pretty soon we coasting again. And when that run out, I said, Mr. Carroll, I have run out of medication. Do you think you could please to give me another bottle? Certainly, son. He handed me another bottle. When that run out, I said, Mr. Carroll, I have run out of rubbing alcohol. Drank that, and when it run out, I said, hey, boy, bring up some more rubber dog. Woo, that old man hit the top of them stairs and said, you look worse now than you did when they brought you in here. Let me see your leg. I hadn't even had any water on it. And that was the end of the rubber dub. The Lord in mercy had to do the rest of them 30 days on nothing but food and water. Suffer, grave, day in the morning. When that 30 days was up and we hit that front stoop of that jail, you'd think the only place in God's world we'd want to go would be the home, to start over. But you know where the first place we went was. That's right. Went to the dime store for another bottle of rubby dust. Over and over. East Coast, West Coast, Canada, Mexico, circuses, carnivals, any kind of a job that would make a living. No holds barred. Dying by degrees and still loving and still hurting. Yes, still loving and still hurting. Sometimes when I'd be in a small town where the houses were spaced far apart, and I'd be alone, sitting in the shadow of a tree where they couldn't see me long about twilight, and I'd look at the houses and watch the children at play. And that town was my town. And those children were my children. And the lights that were coming from the homes were the lights in my home. And when the mother came out to tell the children, come in, supper's ready, that would be my wife. And those would be my children saying, a minute, Mama, a minute, Mama. And then when the father would come, he'd say, you come in this house right now, that'd be me calling my baby. And the children would say, fire, 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 because they knew Daddy meant it. And in the house they'd go, and I'd watch as they gathered around the table. Did you wash your hands? Did you wash behind your ears? And this would be me asking my kids if they washed behind their ears. And back to the bathroom, and then the blessing. when all got quiet and everybody bowed their heads, and you couldn't hear what was saying, but you knew that they were praising God for the food, the daily bread. And I'd cry. And as the tears would course down my cheeks, I'd want to watch and I'd want to see this beautiful sight, but I knew I had to move on because pretty soon the law would be there and I'd be back in jail. Not because I'd committed a crime, not because I had done anybody any harm, but because I was sick with a disease that I did not know existed. I had alcoholism and was denied the right of my own freedom and the love of my own flesh and blood. And I was bitter and I didn't know what to do or where to go, and I'd go back and get in a boxcar, and when I'd feel the engine hook up and the steam brake set, it wouldn't make any difference to me where they were going, because I knew nobody was going to meet me when I got off anyhow. Many, many strange things happened to me when I was working with circuses and carnivals. I remember one night between shows, it was raining and we were cold, and a couple of us guys crawled in under some hay to get warm. We had a couple hours to kill. And when I woke up, there was some deep tractor tracks where this man had been laying. The straw pile that I was under hadn't been touched. I remember one time out west, I missed the train, and me and another guy that I'd been drinking with flagged a freight, and we had to hit the middle of this boxcar, and the way you do that, you hit about here and let your body break in. And as we got in, I walked up this end of the boxcar, and he walked to the other end. The next morning when it got daylight, I looked down at the other end, and there was no bottom in the bottom of that car. He had been ground up under those wheels. I'd been spared, and I didn't know why. The time went on, and finally I wound up in Washington, D.C. First, I was contacted by AA in Little Rock, Arkansas, and still give the Little Rock group responsibility or whatever you might call it, credit for my contact with AA. I was in the state hospital for nervous diseases, and two men came out and invited me up to 210 and a half Main Street. I went up there and stayed, and I tended a little. It didn't click. I had to go out. I didn't sober up until 1945. In 1944, I came back into AA. I was in a flop house. Maybe it was another miracle. Maybe it was my spiritual awakening. But I had hot the very last thing in the world that I possessed. It was a leather jacket that I'd gotten from Tom. Opened it, I dropped it and broke it and watched my life's blood run right out on the floor. And I went back and sat down on this cot that wasn't paid for. I held my head in my hands, bemoaning my fate. I'd given up. I knew I didn't have guts enough to commit suicide. I tried that. One time I'd gone in the bathroom at home and took a half a pint, and I'd sat on the throne with both lids down. I didn't want to drown. And I sat there on the throne and turned that gas on and listened to the gas escape and sucked on my bottle and thought about the funeral and how nice I'd look laid out in my new suit, and how folks would come by to pay their respects, and they'd look down in the casket. Oh, don't he look nice since he quit drinking? And I got to thinking about who all would be there. Couldn't think of a soul. Except me and the undertaker and my mother. And anyway, I was getting a headache and running out of whiskey. That is serious. So I got up and I pulled all the paper out of the cracks and flushed them down the commode and went out in the other part of the house and made an announcement. Don't anybody in this house ever have to go to the toilet? A man could die and then nobody'd ever know it. See, I wanted sympathy. I think to this day they wondered what the hell happened. I thought he was gone. Well, I knew then that I didn't have the intestinal fortitude to kill myself, so I had given up. It was my moment of truth. I'd had it. This is the end. And there was a pair of shoes come up alongside of me. I don't know if you ever had a pair of shoes walk up alongside of you or not. But there was a pair of blue serge pants over them. And I thought, Jesus Christ, the fuzz. I can't take this. I looked up and it wasn't the police at all. It was a face of a guy that I had drank with. A face of a guy that I drank squeezings and pink ladies and smoke, rubbish of and bay rum and anything that was too thin to chew. I'd done time with this guy and I knew he was my kind of a drunk, and I looked up at him and his eyes were bright and his voice was clear and he was clean, and I became concerned about him. I never had seen him looking like that before. And I said, Bob, what happened to you? And he said, Charlie, I found a group of people call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And they helped me to get sober. He said, do you think you got an alcoholic problem? I said, yes. And I had. I had run out of it. And this constituted a problem. He said, would you like to go to a meeting tonight? I didn't want to go to no meeting. All I wanted to do was get them eagles out of my stomach. But he kept rattling that scratch in his pocket. He was driving me crazy. I knew that if I did like he wanted me to do, he'd spring. And I said, yes. He took me to an AA meeting and set me right in the front row among the incurables. I sat there and sweat and stretched and squirmed. There's a little fella sitting right next to me, the nicest, cleanest looking little fella you ever seen in your life. Had a problem. Me. Of course, I had a few small lives. Small but active. And in that warm room, they had to be negotiated, I mean. And now that little fellow sits there, and he knew I was tender. He knew if anybody in the world needed Alcoholics Anonymous, it was me. And he knew that if he would say something like, why don't you take a bath? He knew that I'd be hurt and walk out that door and not ever come back. And there that man sat, not wanting to say anything to hurt my feelings, but he didn't want to get lousy either. Finally, he figured it out. He took his cigarette pack out of his pocket, and he said, have a cigarette, and I took two. Long fingernails, you know, you get two. I offered him one back, but he wouldn't take it. He wouldn't have put that in as his nice, clean cigarette. And then he did a thing that I'll never forget. He picked up an ashtray and sat it on the chair between us and said, we'll both use this. This is human compassion at work. We call it love. In AA, we've been having love in before the hippies could grow whiskers. We know what love ends are. And there that night, I don't know what they said, I don't know what they talked about, but I do know that after that meeting, a guy came up to me and he took my hand. And I was a little suspicious, always have been, a man that takes your hand, you know. He took my hand and he put a dollar bill in it and squeezed my hand and patted me on the back and looked me in the eye and said, when I came into AA, I was in the same boat you were in. And didn't tell me what to do with that dollar. He didn't say anything. He just walked off and then he turned around and looked me right in the eye and said, come back. Come back. And you people, you whole room full of people, God bless you, you came around to me and you shook hands and come back, come back. And you men impressed me with your handshakes that were firm. You didn't try to break my poor little old weak hand. You didn't just hand me a limber looking thing like this, you know, like a fish. You shook hands with me sincerely and looked me right in the eye, and I admired you and wanted to emulate you. I wanted to be like you. But you ladies, oh, you ladies, with your lipstick on your lips, had your teeth in. Had your hair combed. Oh, that is beautiful. Them old bags I've been consorting with, some of them looked like a bed that hadn't been made up in about a week. You had your dresses cut so they hung straight all the way around, and you had your cargo battened down so there was no slippage around the hatches. I just thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life, and I wanted to introduce my mother to you and say, these are the people with whom I'm associating, and you said, come back. Come back. And I went back to the flop house that night, and I was sick, and I had a sleepless night, and my mind was like a grasshopper that kept hopping from one subject to another. All night long, and along about dawn, I got up, and it took till almost noon to shave. I didn't take a bath, you said, easy does it. I remember I came up to the club room, was up on Rhode Island Avenue, and I started up that step, and it was a long step. I got about halfway, and I thought, these people don't want me back. And I kept thinking about all night. This kept going through my mind like a drum beat. Come back, come back, come back. Come back. I could hear you saying, come back. I couldn't shut it off like a broken record. And it seemed to me that this was a victory drum, that it was really true. And then it seemed like it couldn't be true. It just couldn't be possible that beautiful women and grand looking, sincere men, real men, the kind of men that you want to be, were telling me, come back. Oh, no, this couldn't be. I've been hallucinating again. Those goddamn BCs again. And I turned around and started to walk away. And then this thing came to me in such a way that I could understand it at my then-present intellectual level. This thing said to me, boy, you better damn sight go up to them people. Because if anybody's going to lose, it's got to be them. You haven't got anything left to lose. just made sense to me. And I turned around and I walked back up and I poked my eyes into that club room, just kind of secretly around the corner. And I looked. And there were these guys in there. One of them saw me and recognized me. He said, "There he is. There's Charlie. There's the guy we're telling you about was in here last night. The son of a bitch was sitting on me." I went on in, and Lord have mercy, I mean, everybody adopted me. Talk about sponsors. Even the guys that come in earlier that morning took over with me. Anything you needed, anything you had, I needed. Shoe strength, fancy. Didn't have no shoes to put them in. Stock, fancy. One guy went home and got me some socks. Another guy got me some shoes. While I was waiting, there was a guy who said, "Man, your feet must be frozen. Why don't you take off your shoes and set your feet up on that radiator?" I did. He was sorry. I didn't have any underwear. I had just started them for obvious reasons. A guy got me some underwear. Another guy gave me a laxative. I needed that too. Actually, I believe that's what hooked me in AA. I couldn't leave if I wanted to. I mean, I was drinking that hot coffee and that laxative and shaking hands and saying, "Excuse me, I got to go." And I loved it. I loved it. I love coming back and talking with you guys and gals. Like, I love coming back and being treated like somebody, like I had sense. I remember the first prayer that I prayed in AA. I remember that I had gotten a $3 a week hall room with a chair painted on the wall. And I remember that I took my shoes off one night and one of them took a weird bounce and bounced back under the bed and I retrieved it. And while I was down on my knees, it seemed so righteous and so apropos that I should thank God, and I did. I said, "Thank you, God, for the day so bright." And I crawled up in that bed and slept just as if I were in some kind of a protective shroud. And I woke the next morning and there was light coming through that old dirty window, and I had always looked at God as if it was light. Light and God were synonymous with me, and it seemed that God was welcoming me to a new day and a new chance and a new opportunity to live again. And I got down on my knees and I said, "Guide me today." And he did. I read the Bible a lot. I love to read it. It's a good book. But nobody, I guess, really interprets the Bible like everybody else, because God didn't make everybody alike. But he made the Bible so that it fits everybody. And it fits me a little different, I guess, than it does a lot of you folks. And I felt like maybe we, everybody in here, in this room, is like the lost sheep. You know that parable of the 99 and the lost sheep? You know, I wonder what really happened when that little sheep got lost. So let's look at it like I might have looked at it 25, 30 years ago, and let's look at it like I look at it now, because we change, we grow. Well, I would have said, well, all them sheep was out there grazing, and one of these little sheep was a pet cat. And that little sheep backed off from the rest of the bunch, and he looked at him, and he said, look at all them woolies. All they do is wag their tails and eat grass and go, that ain't my bag. I'm going to cut out. I'm going to get with the wolves where the action is. And he set sail. That's not the way it happened at all. No, indeed. That's not the way it happened. This little sheep loved it there with those other sheep because that's where his mother lives, and that's where his brothers and sisters, and that's where everything he knew that was good lived. This was the place he belonged, and he wanted to be there more than any other place in the whole world. But one day, he was grazing with the rest of the sheep, and he ate some grass that was particularly good. And it was the best grass he'd ever tasted. And he looked away over here, and he saw another clump of the same kind of grass. And he walked over and ate that. And then he walked away over here, and he got some more. And over here, and he got some more, and further, and on, he got more of this kind of grass. And it started getting dark. And he looked around, and there wasn't another sheep in sight. And he was scared. Scared to death. And he didn't know what to do because he'd never been separated from the flock before. He had always been under the protection of the shepherd with his rod and his staff. And he had never known fear, no warmth. He had never been denied the protection of his flock. He was scared to death, and all he knew to do was call out. Just that plaintive little cry. But the shepherd had already missed him. And he heard him, and he came to him. And when he came to him, do you think he ran over to him with his rod raised high and his staff in the other arm, shouting, say, you little bastard, where you been? Had us all worried to death. Calling the cops and everything. You think that's what the shepherd said? No. Wasn't that way at all. When the shepherd missed him, he listened. And when he heard this little cry, he was relieved. And he went over. And he very quietly approached the scared little sheep, who was trembling with fear. And he walked over to him very slowly and very quietly and very gently. He whispered soothing things in his ears as he picked him up and held him and held him close to his breast. And he patted him and rubbed him and talked reassuringly to him as he brought him back ever so slowly, because he knew that he was scared to death. And he brought him back and ever so gently set him down amongst his own kind. And he didn't leave him then. He stayed with him until he was comforted and quiet. And after he was sure that he was again well established with his own kind, rehabilitated, if you will, only then did he walk back to his high place to watch out for the rest of the flock. And that's the way it was with me and you and you. You were in the place you wanted to be. more than anything in the world. But one day, you took a drink. And this was the grandest thing that had ever happened. And you found another drink, and another, and another. And over here was another party, and another, and another. And one day things were looking dark, and you were lonely, and you were scared to death. You wanted your family, and you wanted the love and the security of being back with your people. And you called out to God. Maybe you weren't even aware of it. I know that a lot of you might have been with your head in a commode going, "Oh God." But God had already missed you. The shepherd had already missed you. And he was listening for your call. And when he heard it, he rejoiced and came to you in the form of another AA member, another of the flock. And he ever so gently, no, he did not come threatening. He did not come shouting. He did not come condemning you for your actions. He came to you and very gently gathered you in his arms. Have you ever had somebody sit on the side of an old, dirty, rumpled bed that you had soiled and put their arm around you and say, "I love you"? Somebody did that to me, and I've done it to many others. I intend to do it to more. And if you're not doing it, you better damn sight start doing it. Because if you're not doing it, somebody's going to be doing it to you. So we're not going to give up on you. AA don't ever give up. And AA gently sets you down amongst your own kind, and somebody stayed with you until you became oriented. And now, yes, the shepherd is back watching. And I'm sure he's over on some high place with his rod and his staff, watching over you and me, knowing we are a member of the flock, created in the image of God. Maybe you're wondering who you are or what you are or what you can do. I know there was an old sponsor of mine one time who was a tough old duck. And I remember one time I said, "This is all right for you guys with your clean shirts. This is all right for you guys with your wives waiting for you to come home. This is all right for you guys with places to live. But how not me? When am I going to get my wife back? When am I going to get a job, something besides pearl diving? When am I going to get out of that $3 a week hall room with the chair painted on the wall? When am I going to get me an automobile to park it?" He said, "Hold on, wait a minute. You..." Charlie says, "Easy does it, one thing at a time." He said, "How long have you been separated from your wife?" I said, 14 years. He said, "How long since you wrote it?" I said, 14 years. He said, "You're going to have to get a pencil." Made sense. He said, "Now about this automobile." He said, "Charlie, automobiles cost money." He said, "Now, you've got to have first, you've got to have a down payment, you've got to have money for tags, you've got to have a license, and you've got to have a place to park it, you've got to have gas money and all this." He said, "How much money have you got?" I said, $3. He said, no, I mean total inventory. I said, $3. He said, us faces, you ain't in the high income bracket. It's liable to take you a while to save enough money. I bought that. Well, there were some unemployed guys there, but I was making $7 a week part-time, and I was looking down my nose at these unemployed. He said, go over in the corner and count yourself. I did come up with one. I said, I'm dealing with a nut. It don't make no difference how many times I count myself. I'm just going to come up with one. You know that, you talk about a slow learner. Where is she? You talk about a slow learner. Lord in mercy. That man was dead for 5 years before I realized what he wanted me to know. He wanted me to know that I was one. That I was no longer a nothing. That I was a something. I was one. And I couldn't be all things to all people, but there were some things I could do. He wanted me to know that I wasn't the smartest guy in the world, but I had some sense. He wanted me to know that I was one child of God. And he wanted me to know that I belonged here. He wanted me to know that I was a member of AA with a voice. But he wanted me to know that I only was one member and I only had one voice, only one vote, and that I could be wrong. I think that if there's anything that I've learned out of this trip this time, is that here in the northeastern section of Arkansas, it's no different to the northeastern section of Texas or the northeastern section of the United States where I go to talk so much. It's no different from the southeast section. It's no different from any other section. And that each and every one of you people here are one child of God. And you can't be all things to all people. But you can be something to somebody. And there are some things that you can do. And whatever it is that you and I can do, we should do, and we must do. And by the grace of God and AA, we will continue to do. God bless you.